So what part of the reason of this particular topic is that we're also running a new module in the master's course on e-health technologies. So what I'll be presenting tonight is just a small snapshot, if you like, of the types of concepts and technologies that e-health has to deal with, obviously from a ICT point of view, but also some of the issues to deal with how to manage, how to design national projects based around electronic health. Part of this, one of my previous roles, which I haven't mentioned there, is I used to be the lead architect at the National eHealth Transition Authority in Australia, and that group actually designed and built the National eHealth Record System that Australia runs, and I'll talk about that in this presentation. So some of this has come from my experiences working at NITA and building and rolling out a national framework as well as a national service for eHealth. So what I want to quickly run through this evening is we'll look at some of the bigger picture issues to do with principles around e-health and strategies. We'll look at architectures. Then I'll get into some details like what type of clinical information technologies are we currently dealing with. And obviously the other major aspect of this is clinical terminologies, and I'll mention a couple in that space. Then go through a couple of example solutions, e-prescriptions, but I'll concentrate a lot on the National eHealth Record Systems to give you a view of how that all operates. Up to that point, that's basically the day in the life of, and then I want to step you through the future day. I mean, where is this all heading? Because we can make an assumption that what we're doing today currently all works fine, but in reality there are lots of challenges in the technologies that eHealth utilises, and we need to look and see, well, what is a future path for eHealth? And it's a long-term path as well, so it's nothing that will happen overnight. But I want to give you a snapshot and a little bit of an example of what the future may hold. So first of all, the first thing you have to always deal with is a strategy for e-health. And some of these are taken from the National Australian Strategy for e-health. But they're very useful in positioning the areas of use or areas that of concern. So in this example here, we have the four areas, the foundations, what are the core foundations behind e-health that need to be managed. And then we have e-health solutions. And basically what these are the, if you like, the vertical use cases that need to be supported. And that could be prescriptions, it could be discharge summaries, it could be national e-health record systems. It's the solution to solve a particular problem that the community needs to address. So those first two is about technology and how that all works. But the biggest issue, really, some of the major issue in terms of having impact is change and adoption. That is, you can't just go out and say, oh, here's all the foundation technologies, here's all the solutions, and therefore the industry or the healthcare sector will just change overnight. It doesn't happen that easily. You need to look at very seriously how the process of change and adoption works, how the rollout of these systems impacts healthcare, from the clinical day-to-day life, as well as how you bring healthcare providers with you along this journey of ICT change, as well as for consumers. You know, consumers have to change as well. Consumers are used to the way healthcare is presented to them, and some of the new solutions such as online e-health records changes the way that they can now interact with their healthcare providers. And another major area of this is governance. How do you manage all this information and all this change? What process do you go through? How do you get accountability and oversight of the health program? And things like safety, you know, making sure that you know the technology changes in here are not going to cause more harm to the consumer is a very important part. So safety of these systems is quite paramount. We always like to start off with principles because that gives us a starting point. And in most big projects, the principles, in this case I'm talking more about architectural principles, how are we going to end up designing the architecture for this service or systems. The principles help us align our thoughts, gives us consensus building mechanisms so that everyone knows these are the principles under which this e-health solution is being developed and built. Here's some example from the Hong Kong e-health record system. And you know, most of them are pretty straightforward. You know, in this case, it's the first one is about how hospital authority systems and know-how is going to be one of the driving forces behind the e-health record system here. Data privacy is going to be important given legal protection. And there's other ones about how the sharing system should be based on open, common technical standards. So, you know, that's a major one there. You don't want to build a proprietary solution. You want to go to the market and say, well, show me the open standards based for e-health and we'll adopt them, etc. So there's a number of principles there. In Australia, we had a lot more, you know, but there's no, you know, but the concept is the same. Each of these principles are obviously detailed in a lot more detail than this, but they give you a starting point to understand where you want to be and where you want to deliver your architecture. And the simile here is like, this has got observed standards here, which is similar to this one back here. So when you start looking at building an e-health architecture, you know, we know that e-health is a complex, or healthcare is a complex sector, a complex domain, and involves a very similar complex ICT solutions. There's a lot of stakeholders in the healthcare sector, you know, from providers, third parties, to consumers, healthcare providers, public, private enterprises, all working together. And, you know, and we all are aware that, you know, if there are serious consequences from if the systems start to fail, and they can lead to consequences that we don't want to really have to deal with. So what typically happens, and you know, we have a design process, and most cases they are requirements driven. So you have a very formal governance process around gathering requirements from all the stakeholders about what they want the system to do, what are their requirements, and then that enables you to build up use cases and scenarios, and these start to become all the artifacts you use to design the architecture and the eventual rollout of the solution. There's then a process of looking at what are the community models, what are the capability models for e-health. I'll give a couple of examples of those in a moment, to help you understand and visualise how the systems interact with each other and what the impacts are from these models. When you get down to the nitty-gritty architecture design, we always like to look at the current state architecture and the target state architecture, so where you are right today and where you want to be in the future. And then from that process, you can work out what paths you need to take to get to, obviously, the target architecture. And we use a typical, if you're familiar with model-driven architectures and RMODP, which my students should be, but not everyone is. Now, we look at the conceptual layer, the logical layer, and implementable layer. So it's a real clear reason why we do that, which we'll show you in a moment. And of course, we also differentiate between information, that is static stuff, versus services, stuff that happens dynamically, which have to model those separately in most cases. All this is always captured in some sort of high-level system architecture, which gives you a broad overview of healthcare architecture. And that typically becomes a very complex diagram with lots of pictures and boxes and arrows going all over the place, which architects love to draw. One of the things, lessons we learnt in Australia was the need for an architecture design authority. That is, that this whole process of creating all these architectures and right up to requirements requires a design authority to manage the process. It's like I mentioned before, the governance process. Otherwise, things change without other people knowing, dependencies can be impacted. So having an architecture design authority is of paramount importance in designing e-health systems, particularly ones of national importance. So a couple of examples. This is a capability model where we look at, for example, the typical e-health solutions up there. And, you know, there's things like diagnostic services, continuity of care services, discharge, referrals, telehealth, etc. So there's a number of solutions that would be prioritised as to which ones will be built and delivered. And then, of course, we have foundations, because we need to build all these solutions based on common foundations, and these are always to do with things like identifiers, authentication, secure messaging, access control, clinical terminology, supply chain, etc. So these are all the foundation technologies that should be there, that are common, that all these services need to build upon. So that's what a capability model looks like. A community model looks at more the people. That's why there's more people icons on this particular diagram. So we look at things like, well, if we look at the community model, how does the community operate? We have like primary care, for example, over here, and there's participants in there. We have acute care with participants over in that case, in area there. We then have, you know, the change and adoption issues over here. We have people, consumers, the education, training, etc., standards and conformity assessment and that side over here, and then we have the e-health services that these communities will want to access and build upon. So that's another view of an architecture. It's a community view of how the e-health solution should be addressing these particular needs, and these all become stakeholders in the requirements and the rollout of the eventual services, because they're the ones that have to actually use these services. Then we get into more complex diagrams now, because we're starting now to put everything together. So we have an architecture, a high-level system architecture, and this tries to bring together all these various other architectural models together. And you know, these can become quite complex and very difficult to read, but in general it's there, so you can understand that it's a there's a lot of layer of complexity there. But we try and build in where the interactions are. So at the top there we have the eHealth community. Then we have a number of ways of gateways, for example up here via secure messaging into national infrastructure services, other online services, and all the clinical domains that we want to do: medications management, continuity of care, diagnostic services, terminologies, secure messaging, clinical information. They're all there, part of the overall architecture. So that's part of the architecture design, is trying to communicate what you're trying to build, communicate with all the stakeholders. And these are very non-technical diagrams at the end of the day. There's nothing technical about them. They're just diagrams to communicate and help the stakeholders to build up consensus about what we're trying to solve. So then when we say, okay, well, now let's focus on clinical information, because that's one of the key things that happens every day, clinical information. And the most common standard for clinical information is from HL7. HL7 is the standards body. It's an international standards group, healthcare level 7, and they've developed a reference information model. And that the RIM, as it's known as, is basically an information model covering the entire healthcare space. Now they've tried to capture the entire space with the RIM. So the RIM, or the reference information model, basically enables you to develop the grammar for how you're going to build messages, and how bits of data are related in the RIM, and how we, and also data types, you know, whether it's a date, for example, and stuff like that. So the RIM gives you that ability to then start to express very specific information requirements. So the RIM is a very complex diagram. This is a simplification of the RIM. So if you've ever seen it, it's a UML diagram. It's multiple colours, and it's about 10 times more complex as this diagram here. But the RIM really is about, you know, the main entities, and the RIM basically contains entities, which are usually people, organisations. They play roles. They have a participation in a particular encounter with an act. So an act is the key verb in the RIM, and the act is things like procedures, substance administration, documents, observations, for example. That's all part of acts. Including that acts also things like administrative things like invoices and accounts and stuff like that. So this model here is trying to represent the entirety of the healthcare domain, because that's the way that the this modelling technique works. Is you need to come up with the entire domain, and then when you're interested in specific parts, you then constrain it and say, well, I'm only interested in substance administration, I only want to know about that. So you constrain the model down to substance administration with particular participants, with patients, with people playing the role of a patient, for example. That's how you go about using the RIM. But that's just sort of like the beginnings of where you start from your day using clinical information. What typically happens is we look at the conceptual layer in terms of what concepts in clinical information do we want to capture. We look at a logical view of that, and then we look at an implementable view. That's our three modelling layers, if you like. So conceptually, we build clinical models, and these are built by healthcare providers themselves. So it's their experience about what a clinical model looks like, what does an adverse reaction contain, what's the procedure contain, what's a pathology result. They come from domain experts, and these are little building blocks for information that would eventually be part of a clinical message between two providers, healthcare providers. And it's very conceptual, so there's nothing, you're not worried about implementing it, you want to get the semantics right, you just want to talk about the ideas. Then when you come up with some use cases and some business requirements, you say, well, I'm going to actually now build a prescription service. You know, that's my use case. We then start to build particular documents based around those use cases. So you have a document specification called prescription, and you may have a discharge summary, etc. And these document specifications we take these clinical models, parts of them, and build them together into one of these models here. And it becomes a more of a targeted use case. And typically they're documents because that's what the industry is used to. Most things are happening at a document level. These are still logical in the sense that they have no implementation details in them. You can implement these in any way you like. And then, of course, the next thing you're going to do is implement them. But that depends on what your platform is. And depends on who your vendors are that you're going to choose. Etc. So you then look at how do you encode these document specifications in different particular encodings, XML, HR7, V2 and FHIR, and all these are wonderful technologies. But the key idea is to keep that separation, because this changes a lot, this layer will change a lot. Right, you'd hope that doesn't change that often, because these things shouldn't change. Adverse reactions are adverse reactions, conceptually. Shouldn't change every day. And these don't change that often, but they do over time change. You have different types of documents. In Australia, we built a shared health summaries as new types, event summaries as new types of documents that were above and beyond the typical ones like discharge summaries and referrals and stuff like that. So there's a reason why you keep them separate to make sure so you can change your platforms and you won't impact the higher layers. But there's also a negative aspect to that, which I'll talk about in a moment as well, because it does come back and makes it more difficult from an interoperability point of view. So documents, it seems to be the main architecture. Again, HL7, the standards body, has another standard called CDA, Clinical Document Architecture. And CDA is a mechanism where you take the RIM, I showed you before, those concepts in the RIM, and actually gets you to encode that in a machine format like XML. So you can actually use it as a message between a healthcare provider and a hospital, for example, because it has to be some machine rendering of it to move it across the system. So as you can see here, this is what a CDA document looks like. You have a header, in the header is stuff about who, what, when, where. So it tells you who the patient is, who the doctor was, when it happened, where it happened. And then the body of the document is really about what happened, whether it's a procedure, whether it was a substance administration. The body can have multiple parts of that. Of course, there's sections and they have narratives, which is for human readability, and then you have these clinical statements, which is for machine readability. So the CDA document actually plays two roles. It's a document for showing to people in a human way, human readable text, what the purpose is of this particular document, and it's also used by machines. Because what machines are looking for, as we see later, is tell me this is text, human text, that I showed the user, because it might say that, you know, Johnny came in today and he had a sprained leg and I gave him an aspirin and told him to go away. That could be the text. But in this clinical statement, there might be encodings here for terminologies that say it gives you very explicitly what medicine you gave and what condition he came in. And that's where we look at terminologies being used a lot in this area here. So the document architecture tries to bring together the human readability of a document, which most of the people are aware of, but hidden behind it is all the machine terminology codes. And one of the key aspects of HL7 CDA is that whatever you write in here as text has to be represented in a machine format. That is, you should leave that out, of course, and just have narratives only, but once you start putting in the machine terminology codes in here, they have to match what's in there, which is always a challenge.
Is that done automatically?
There's been attempts to do it automatically, but typically they don't meet the protocol safety guidelines, because if you make a mistake in that matching, then you could have some adverse reactions, for example. Yeah. That's a very big research area that's been worked on. So that's what typically happens. Typically today, the CDA architecture is one of the most common ways to encode clinical documents and send them around. But very recently, HL7, and, well, if you're familiar with CDA, you understand that it's a very complex specification, very difficult to understand. And HL7 then decided, well, let's have another, more simpler way to encode clinical data. And it's called FHIR. I'm not sure why they called it FHIR, but it stands for Fast Healthcare Interoperability Resources. And basically what FHIR is, it's a much simplified way of looking at the clinical data and how they are related to each other. And basically, again, you assemble the bits of the FHIR resources together, and you can still make a document, but typically it's more for smaller bits of data being shipped around. And it's using common web protocols like JSON and REST interfaces to get that data between two servers. So you don't typically have to rely on a heavy security-based infrastructure in there. So it's an evolutionary development from HL7 V2 and CDA. So V2 is an earlier version, if you like, of messaging for HL7. It's not XML. It's a very arcane syntax behind it all. And of course, FHIR can be extended out, etc. So FHIR looks a bit more like this. So it's much more relevant in terms of, it just says there are things like, here's a medication prescription, and here is the dosage instruction for it, and here's all the attributes about it, and here's when dispense it, here's a dispense thing, and here's some information about whether it can be substituted as well. So if you're familiar, that's like a nice little UML model there, and this is all can be encoded quite simply in XML, and everything works quite straightforward. But still, these are all defined by the FHIR spec, so it talks about all of these as items that are, if you like, represent the entire healthcare domain. So this is just now becoming a draft standard in HL7, so it's not hasn't been around as long as CDA, for example, but it's much more easy to use, there's still some learning process about how to deploy it in a large scale. In the National eHealth Record System in Australia, we use CDA pretty exclusively. That decision was made about 5 years ago, and there was no such thing as FHIR then. But when you look at shipping around small bits of information, even something as small as your child's current weight, because we use that in some of our health information, you still have to create a document for that. Even though the data is really small, you've still got to go through the overheads of creating a document. But FHIR, of course, there's a lot less overheads, because it's just, you can just say the resources are that patient and the data is just the weight sort of value of that, all the overheads. So this is, FHIR is actually a good step forward. So then we move on to clinical terminologies, another major area of healthcare technologies. And there's quite a number of them around, but there are some very common ones. ICD-10 is commonly used for classifying diseases and other things like statistical purposes. Low ink is for laboratory results, and these like for example, low ink is used a lot in clinical documents. They actually use those terminology to classify the document. But SNOMED is probably the most comprehensive clinical terminology, and it again tries to cover a large area of the whole clinical domain. And as you can see here, there's about 400,000 concepts in there, with about 800,000 description terms and about 1.2 million relationships between all these terms. So it's a very complex, huge ontology. But you know, as it is, SNOMED CT, it's quite a massive undertaking, and it's also an international undertaking by lots of countries. But you can also profile it into smaller, what we call reference sets. So if you're not interested in entire SNOMED, and all you want to do is look at, say, emergency department sort of issues, then you can then profile it down, and you can remove all the stuff that's nothing to do with emergencies. So you can have reference sets for specific domains. So SNOMED is modelled quite nicely. It's probably one of the most nicely modelled terminologies. And you know, you can have, everything's got an ID, so you can have a concept ID there, and you can do things like describe them. Here is some describing with you know, types of names, preferred terms, synonyms, etc. And then you have things like, what is this myocardial infarction? What is it? It's a structured disorder of the heart. Is there associated morphology? Its finding site. So you can give a lot of information about where that concept occurred on the body, for example, and also what is it also related to? Because those 1.2 million relationships I talked about is one of the powers of SNOMED, and we'll see that a bit later on why they're so powerful. So SNOMED is actually quite a it hasn't been rolled out a lot in terms of real life deployment, particularly in our case in Australia, but it's moving towards that. But this complexity does hold it back a bit, because it is quite a large, complex terminology. And one of the nice things about SNOMED, if you're going a bit technical here, is what's called post-coordination, in that most terminologies give you here's all our terms. ICD-10, for example, says here are all the terms for diseases. Lowing says here are all the terms for pathology results. But it doesn't allow you to create more concepts or relate them. But when SNOMED allows you to do that, it can actually pull together different concepts and put them together, so you come up with a post-coordinated new concept. So, for example, here's an example here. You have third-degree burn of the left index finger caused by hot water. Now, that concept doesn't occur or appear in SNOMED at all. But you can build that concept. And this is the syntax, don't worry too much about it. But you can take the different concept IDs, put them together, and you come up with this new syntax here. And this basically represents a new concept, which is this one up here. But it's built together using, you know, you can see causative agent, the finding site, laterality, etc. there, burn of the skin. You build it up, and the nice thing about this is that SNOMED is based on a formal model. It's actually based on a mathematical model called description logics that's extensible. And so when you do that, it actually preserves the semantics. So typically you don't have something silly coming out of the end of it, and it helps you do inferencing as well. We'll see that a bit later on. So that's one of its powers. It's not just a fixed list of terms. You can actually build and create additional concepts in a post-coordinated way. So let's look at a couple of examples. So ETP, or electronic transfers of prescriptions, is probably one of the biggest areas where you can have the most impact for ICT solutions. In Australia, for example, there's about it costs about $380 million every year in the public hospital systems from medication errors. So that's a huge amount of money, and it's probably one of the areas that, because of the negative outcomes from misuse or accidents or misuse or errors from medication, then you know they can actually have quite serious outcomes on the patients. And for ETP, in this example here, ETP, you know, when you look at managing prescriptions, you do need a third party in the architecture, because typically a patient will go to the doctor, get a prescription, but that means they can go to any pharmacy to actually dispense that prescription. And that's where you need to have some third party to coordinate where how that process would occur. But typically you have a prescriber here who gives a patient some type of prescription, and that'll be some electronic prescription, of course, and you typically might be just a barcode. And you have a barcode. That prescriber will actually submit that signed prescription, so it's authenticated into the prescription exchange service. There might be multiple of those that are distributed, but there is a third party there. The patient then can go choose their favourite pharmacy and go to the dispenser. The dispenser says, okay, you look at your barcode, and gets a scanner or whatever, and that will then, of course, will go that to the exchange to verify that does exist, what's in there, and then, of course, will dispense it, tell the exchange, yep, this has been dispensed, and if there's multiple repeats, etc., it'll change the flags, etc. So that's where we're moving to, having completely automated prescriptions instead of having paper, which can be scribbled by hand and misinterpreted, and etc. It will be managed from in a more ETP. So that's a very simple scenario, but the more bigger picture one is where you look at a complete electronic medication management system, where it covers things like scheduling, ordering, notification, administration, so that you might have a dispenser that also tells a third-party healthcare organisation, like an aged home care organisation that has a lot of patients on medications, that say, okay, this patients are running out of meds. You know, we need to inform the doctor to prescribe some more, and that can be part of a whole solution architecture. So when we start looking at the bigger picture, you can see a lot of possibilities for automating the entire electronic medication management use case. It can be quite a large use case. The other sort of scenario I want to mention is the national e-health record systems. The idea here is that we can start to share information better than we're currently doing in the sector, so that we can improve continuity of care particularly for consumers who access multiple providers. The ability to have a single repository that has all your e-health records and available to a wide range of providers makes it a lot easier for the providers to understand your history, and then therefore hopefully a lot easier for them to make decisions about what future courses of healthcare you should take. And hopefully also help in reducing avoidable errors, medication errors, and other types of adverse events as well. The other benefit is it enables the individual also to participate more in their own healthcare once they start seeing how the big pictures are put together, when they go see different providers and see how that information can be linked together. And you know, there's a lot of benefits improving more diagnostics and treatment capabilities. And another big area, of course, is technically that's how it solves it, but you also need national legislation and regulations to run it, because it is a big system. There's privacy issues to deal with, and there's a lot of regulations to make sure that healthcare providers have the right processes in place to manage access and uploading documents. So in Australia, we have the PCEHR, which is the Personally Controlled E-Health Record System. Each person can actually, it's an opt-in system, and you can log into a consumer portal. There's a national consumer portal, but there's also the ability for third parties to have portals as well. So it's an open system. Anyone can build their own portal into the PCHR. Providers can upload information, clinical documents typically, and you as a consumer can view them. You've got good access control mechanisms, and you can also manage your family members. You know, you can help your children can have a health record, your older parents can have them, and you can manage them on their behalf as well. So there's a lot of management care that's being pushed to the consumer to help them manage their family, direct family as well. So it's quite a big undertaking. So the National eHealth Record System, basically you can upload, you know, clinical documents, shared health summaries, event summaries, discharge summaries, etc. They'll upload it into there. There's portals. Providers have portals. Your local clinical information systems, you know, it's not meant to replace a local CIS, clinical information system. It's meant to augment it. So the idea is that the doctors don't throw away their CIS systems. They still use them as they would normally do, but whenever that doctor has an encounter, they'll have their own local records, but then they may upload that part of that record as a event summary, for example, to the national service up here. So that's the idea behind the national service. And then, of course, the national service also can talk to other repositories. For example, in Australia, the eHealth system can talk to our Medicare database, so we can get a list of all the prescriptions you've had, for example, prescribed and dispensed medicines, etc. So that's another repository, but that can be integrated into the health system as well. So it's not everything in one big massive database. Part of it is still separately managed. So to give you a good idea, that's what the interface looks a bit like, the National eHealth Record System in Australia. And it gives you a summary of the current documents and recent clinical documents and access to them over there. And then when you click on one of the current documents, you'll pop up, you know, this is a shared health summary for that particular patient and the details, et cetera, who did it and the observations and all there. That's all. That is a CDA document, just rendered as a HTML document. So this is actually an XML document that's stored as a in CDA format. Of course, here in Hong Kong, you have an eHealth record system too. This is, I think, one of the maybe a screen dump from a sample prototype, and you can see there's a similar idea. Is it trying to give a summary of you know, what's happened for in different areas, encounters in the lab, allergies, and the prescriptions summary as well. And Singapore has done the same similar thing, and there you can sort of see the similar sort of. Snapshot of a dashboard view, if you like, of the eHealth record system. So at this point you may think, well, that's all lovely, it all works fine, and in most cases it does, but when you start looking a bit more as to where we can improve things, particularly for how we model information to get the best outcomes. Some of the issues we have currently that the RIM has, for example, there are issues about whether it's designed as a, because it's designed as a closed system, what we mean by that is that it tries to model the entire healthcare domain. And of course, that means that that's all you can do. So if you look at it, you say, well, that's all I can do, but if I have different processes in that or different information, then I'm a bit stuck as to how to extend it out. Because it's typically designed for constraint-based modelling, which is you take the whole model and you pull out the stuff that you only want. Whereas the most modelling and the way that the real world sort of, or the open world works, is that you model something and then you extend it out for stuff that you want to do. So you don't take the whole thing and then constrain it down. You actually start off with a smaller model, but you extend it out from that to meet your requirements. So that's the difference between a closed system and what we call an open world system. But anyway, some of the issues with the RIM, the acts that I mentioned before are quite large and overwhelming. CDA produces very complex XML. These are very technical things, but they can get in the way of interoperability. And those layers I talked about before, conceptual, logical implementation, they cause interoperability issues because there's no linkages between them formally when you get to the implementation layer. Once you get to the implementation layer, you lose the linkages between those layers. And in a lot of cases, SNOMED and HL7 CDA actually can compete with each other, because SNOMED can actually, in some cases, express the same thing that CDA can do, particularly in the content side. But the model completely differently. So once you start using SNOMED inside CDA, you can get to a situation where you then have to understand completely those two different modelling techniques for the information structures as well as the terminology. The semantic web is something that's been around for a while, W3C, and it's basically a series of technologies that people are now trying to apply to e-health. because they can see that if we had a better, more formal model for modelling clinical data, we can move towards a more automated decision making. And when I say automated decision making, something that has guaranteed outcomes, so that you can always be assured that if two systems have the modelled information using the semantic web, when they reason about it or infer some information, that the outcome is exactly the same. Because the worst thing you want to do is have two different outcomes from two different systems, because then you're going to have a lot of adverse reactions. Now, the good thing about this is that SNOMED is actually based on the same model of the semantic web, which is the description logics. So give a quick example as to the problem, if you like. So what happens today is you have a two clinical documents. So you might have a health summary, you might have a prescription document. And you model them, you say for your health summary, you're going to have in one section you have an adverse reaction, and it's going to be some substance or agents in there, and its value domain is where the values come from, and you may say it comes from SNOMED, and particularly from a particular reference set here. This is the Substance Foundation reference set, so one small subset of SNOMED can be used for that particular adverse reaction field. In your e-prescription, you might have in this Australian case, we have the therapeutic good identification. That's basically the ID of the medicine. And that will have a value domain of the Australian Medicines Terminology, AMT. And because they're modelled separately, when you implement them, and this is the only time I'll show XML to you, you get this XML code. So this XML code here is actually this value here. So this code here, that number there is actually penicillin as an adverse reaction from SNOMED, as a disorder. Similarly, in your prescription, you have some more XML code, you have this big number here, and this is a number from AMT, and this is and it tells you that the prescription is for moxicillin, trihydrate, 500 milligrams, whatever. So that works, right? There's nothing wrong with that. But the problem is there's no relationships between that code and this code anymore. It's lost. It's lost out there. It's forever lost. Because it might be modelled way up the top level conceptually, fine, but once you get down to this level here, the machine says it sees this number here, sees that number there, says, great, I know what that means here, I know what that means here, that's all I'm going to do about it. I'm not going to even try and compare them, because there's nothing to tell me to even look at comparing them. So that's one of the biggest issues we have when we start to have a model, an information model like CDA, and we try and then build into it, particularly here, a terminology model. The two different models almost competing with each other. So what the semantic web tries to do, or the semantic approach, is that imagine this is your new use case. You have a person who has an allergy, which has a causative agent of some substance. You have a prescription, a particular medicine, which has an ingredient in the medicine of a particular substance. Okay, you can model that using semantic web technologies, RDF and OWL are the two, but I won't go into details. If we start looking at that box now we're going to say, well, how can we sort of link those together? But this is where you want to link these together to make sure that when that person has a particular allergy, you don't want to give them a particular medicine that could cause an adverse reaction. So let's take a simple case, moxicillin we had before and penicillin. And that should be around the wrong way, shouldn't it? Sorry, imagine those are around the wrong way. Sorry, am I in my haste? So that's moxicillin there and penicillin. The idea is the same. So, but because before I mentioned those 1.2 million relationships in SNOMED, this is where they start to work. Because you can say that moxicillin is a moxicillin trihydrate. It's also is a moxicillin. It's also a amino penicillin. And of course, that is a, if you chop them around, that is actually a moxicillin. That's what SNOMED tells me. All these is as relationships. And the good thing is that because SNOMED tells me that, all that stuff is inferred automatically for me. So I don't have to do any extra coding as a programmer. I don't have to write code and always check this hierarchy every time. The semantic web through its reasoners, which is the software that actually understands the mathematical model, and these are all open source reasoners, will infer that for you automatically. So that you can imagine a system where that I'm about to prescribe someone some moxicillin and they have an allergy to penicillin, right? And imagine this is all linked up like this, then the system will come back and tell you, hey, stop, This person has an allergy to penicillin. That medicine contains penicillin because I followed the hierarchy. So you could then warn the prescriber, this is not, you shouldn't prescribe this particular medicine. So that's a very simple use case, but that's the whole idea of how the terminology modelled in such a way can actually benefit quite significantly to the providers and consumers. So we want to take that and look at the document structure as well, because the document structure doesn't have that capability at all. It's just straight XML, which is very static information. So to wrap up, as I mentioned, eHealth has a lot of complex information standards, which it has to, because it's a non-trivial domain. HL7, CDA and FHIR are very useful still today, and particularly and for the immediate future. But there are some challenges in preserving that linkage between the document model and the terminology models, particularly when you start using SNOMED together. So we need to look at how we can move towards those two models having the same underlying concepts based on the mathematical model. And as I just showed you, the semantic web can help you in that area. The most important thing, of course, is that for decision support systems, we can now have guaranteed outcomes. So if you start building decision support systems based on the underlying models, we can have outcomes that will reduce clinical errors. And of course, in the long term, it won't happen overnight. We're talking about a 10-year pathway to get to this point. Over that period, you'll be able to see a lot of improvements in both the provider decisions that they make as well as for consumer healthcare outcomes. And that's the end of my presentation. Yep. Okay, thanks so much.